This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Allen County Right to Life, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Eschelbach, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Eschelbach.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is a joint project of Allen County Right to Life, Indiana Right to Life, and Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And now, the pro-life news.
On Wednesday, September 21st, the Select Investigative Panel of the U.S. House of Representatives approved a report recommending that STEM Express and its chief executive officer, Catherine Spears Dyer, be held in contempt of Congress for failing to comply with lawfully issued subpoenas. Here are excerpts from a statement by Tennessee Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, who chairs the panel. Quote, 9 months is enough time for an entity to produce accounting documents. It is our hope that by approving this report today, STEM Express and its CEO, Kate Dyer, will begin to take our investigation seriously. End quote. Blackburn went on to say, quote, a subpoena is not a suggestion. It is a lawful order that must be complied with. End quote.
Today, we have here in studio with me, Dr. Christina Francis, a local OBGYN. Hi, Christina.
Hi. Nice to be back with you.
Yeah, we always love having you. Christina, if you haven't met her before, she's wonderful. She's done some speaking engagements for us, but she graduated from the IU Med School. She's been a practicing OBGYN for 7 years now. Three of those years, she was living in Kenya practicing. So that's pretty fantastic. It's amazing to ask her about that experience if you have a chance. She also serves as a member of the board of APLOG, so the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists,
that's
which
right.
is a mouthful.
It is a mouthful.
And a fantastic organization to be a part of. So Christina's here today to help us with a piece of the pro-life movement and the pro-life rhetoric that often seems kind of scary. So we have what we call the hard cases. So we have rape and incest, and then we have life of the mother. And this is an argument that's often used by the pro-choice side to kind of shut up the pro-lifers. And so we want to talk about that a little bit today, to dig into that and to sort of uncover what we can talk about in there and what is actually all bound up in that. Because it's sort of become this phrase that has a bow wrapped around it and they throw it like a grenade and expect it to sort of wipe out all of our arguments. And really, it doesn't. And it's a great thing for us to know about and to have our facts on. And so that's why we have Dr. Christina Francis with us today. So, Christina,
yes,
what is the general basis of the life of the mother argument, and why is it important that we know how to respond?
Well, you know, Abby, I agree with you that I think a lot of people who argue for abortion to stay legal and for abortion rights like to use this argument because they know that it's a difficult argument to respond to. So people do like to bring up the hard cases, like you said, those involving rape or incest, and then those involving the life of the mother, because, like I said, those are hard cases. They're difficult to talk about. But as you said, they don't need to shut us down when people bring that up. I think the first thing to remember is that those cases combined, rape and incest, as well as cases in which the life of the mother truly is in jeopardy, account for less than 1% of all abortions that are performed. So even though this is an argument that's used extensively to support abortion rights, it actually only accounts for less than 1% of all abortions that are done. So that's important for us to remember as we're talking to people. You know, is that really the reason that they think abortion should be legal? So oftentimes I'll bring up to people, okay, well, let's say we outlaw abortion for all other reasons. Are you okay with that then? If you're truly saying you only support abortion in cases of life of the mother or rape and incest, most times people don't just support abortion in those cases. They're just using it because it's a difficult case. So when we're talking about life of the mother, I think there's kind of a nuance or maybe semantics that need to be addressed in that. Oftentimes people, or the way laws are written, will be life or health of the mother. And that's an important distinction. So when they talk about health of the mother, that can mean any number of things. It can mean mental health. So if a woman is stressed out by her pregnancy, which I don't know that I know a single woman who hasn't been stressed out at some point in time during her pregnancy, that could be seen as a health risk to the mother, and that can be used as justification in many states for a woman to have an abortion. So health is very different from life of the mother. When we're talking about true life of the mother cases where a woman's life is significantly endangered or is in imminent risk because of a pregnancy, then there are cases where maybe her pregnancy needs to be ended early, truly to save her life. But those cases are exceedingly rare.
What are some of those cases?
Sure. So some cases that even I myself have dealt with would involve like an ectopic pregnancy, which is one that sometimes people don't necessarily think about. But this is a situation where a pregnancy is legitimately jeopardizing the life of that mother. That would be probably the most common example where a woman's life truly is in jeopardy. There are some other ones, such as a situation called chorioamnionitis, which is an infection. It's a big word. That's right. But basically, it's an infection of the amniotic fluid that's surrounding the baby that can cause sepsis or a systemic or blood infection in the mother. And that is a situation where the mom's life is truly in jeopardy. And the only way to cure that, you can't fix it just by giving the woman antibiotics. The only way to cure that is by affecting delivery. And when that happens, prior to the time that baby is viable or able to survive on his or her own outside of mom, then sometimes inducing labor or, you know, affecting delivery for mom does then lead to the death of the baby, which is certainly a very, very difficult and unfortunate situation.
Right. And in the pro-life movement, we don't regard things like ectopic pregnancies where that pregnancy needs to be removed. The baby has to be removed from her fallopian tube. And we wouldn't consider that an abortion, per
right.
se, because the intent of it is not to kill the baby.
Exactly.
If we could, we would save that baby.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, that's where certainly defining what an abortion is. So abortion is the intentional killing of an innocent human being. The only intention of an abortion is to end the life of that child. And certainly an ectopic pregnancy isn't. Our intent in performing surgery where we remove that portion of the tube where the or wherever the baby is located. So most commonly in the tube, it can be located in the ovary. It can be located in a part of the uterus that it shouldn't be and that can cause hemorrhage. But basically removing that part of mom's anatomy where baby is growing, we're doing that to save the mother's life. Our intention is that in that is not to kill that child. That is an unintended consequence of what we're doing, but that's not our intention. So we're not directly acting with an intent to kill that child. If we allow mom to die, both mom and baby are going to die, and then we've lost two lives. And I always like to say that we are pro all life. We're pro life of the mother and we're pro life of the baby. And so if we have to make a choice where we can only save one, then we have to save one if we can. Eventually, if there would be technology where I could take baby out of the tube and transplant baby into mom's uterus, then absolutely that would be what I would have to do. And just a little side note, as far as that goes, I have seen things circulating that say that that technology exists. It doesn't. So I just want to clear the record there.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Unfortunately, that technology does not exist. If one day it could, and I think research needs to be done in that direction, then absolutely, as a pro-life physician, it would be incumbent on me to do that. But currently, we have to intervene. Same thing as if mom has an infection. Or I had a situation not all that long ago with a woman who came in pregnant and she was only about 20 weeks, so prior to when baby could survive outside of her. Mm-hmm. And she had a severe placental abruption, which is where the placenta is pulling away from the wall of the uterus.
Yeah.
And it was causing her body actually to go into a condition called DIC, which could lead to massive life-threatening hemorrhage. In that case, we had to induce her labor and get her delivered. Otherwise, she would have started hemorrhaging really significantly. And again, I knew in inducing her labor that her little tiny baby at only 20 weeks was not going to be able to survive outside of her. And that was a gut-wrenching decision for me to have to make. Mm-hmm. To start her induction, knowing that that was ultimately going to lead to the death of her baby. But again, that wasn't my intent. My intent was only to save her life. But we were able to do it in a humane way and in a respectful way where we still gave her baby the respect that he deserved, allowing her to be able to hold him. And he actually lived for a couple of hours. And,
wow.
And you know, she was able to hold him and have time with that baby.
Yeah.
Whereas had she gone through a destructive abortion procedure, she wouldn't have had that ability to
right.
do that. So, you know, while these are gut-wrenching decisions that do have to be made, and I think it's also important to caution people who are pro-life and making arguments along this line to not minimize the reality that this does happen sometimes, to not minimize it, especially for women who've gone through that and for physicians like me who have had to make these decisions. But again, these are rare cases. They don't happen that often. These are not abortions. If you look at the definition of what abortion is, and this is really not what the majority of the debate is in this country.
Touching really quick on that, there is a term out there, spontaneous abortion. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that for us? Because that's one that I know has tripped up people who have talked to me in my office about it. Sure. And said, Abigail, what is this?
Sure. So essentially, from a medical standpoint, the term abortion refers to the ending of a pregnancy prior to 20 weeks gestation. So a spontaneous abortion would be an ending of a pregnancy that occurs spontaneously. So no one caused it to happen. Essentially, it's a miscarriage. So a miscarriage that happens prior to 20 weeks gestation would be called a spontaneous abortion. I've had many patients who found this on their medical record and were really upset by it.
Right. That's exactly it.
Yeah. Because they said, well, I didn't have an abortion. But it is purely in that sense, a medical term. So it just means the ending of a pregnancy prior to 20 weeks gestation. In the medical field, when we're referring to abortion in the way that the general public thinks of abortion,
right,
we might say elective abortion or induced abortion, mm-hmm, or elective termination of pregnancy. Those are some other terms that might be used. So certainly for any woman who might have found that on her medical record and was upset by that, a spontaneous abortion simply means a miscarriage.
Right. And when I was going through medical interpreter training, Spanish English, that's a term that, right, is the same. I mean, they use it in Spanish the same. It's spontaneous abortion.
Sure.
For a miscarriage.
Right.
And that's what the translation says too, like in the dictionaries that you look up. But it's one, right, that trips people up. So do be conscious of that. So we talked about ectopic pregnancies, and that's one that comes up a lot that I've heard at least. And you mentioned a couple other situations that occur where the mom's life during the pregnancy is threatened and the baby has to be removed in order to save the life of the mom.
Right.
And if the baby's young enough, the baby may not be able to survive.
Right.
What about situations where the mom is already at a risk and then becomes pregnant, and so her risk is hiked up higher? What about those situations?
Sure. So a lot of times where we encounter that are women that have pre-existing medical conditions that pregnancy wouldn't be recommended. So one of the big categories of that would be women with really severe, typically congenital heart conditions, where the stress of pregnancy is seen to be too much for their heart and could tip them over into congestive heart failure or potentially even lead to their death. Again, these situations are rare, but they certainly are out there. However, these are women that definitely pregnancy is not recommended. So if I were seeing them in my office and they were asking me, should I get pregnant? I would tell them absolutely not. It's a significant stress on your body and you shouldn't get pregnant. But the important thing to remember is once they are pregnant, almost the moment a woman becomes pregnant, but certainly within the first 1 to 2 weeks prior to the time that most women even know that they're pregnant,
right,
most of those physiologic changes that occur, the increase in blood volume, the changes in blood pressure, the changes in heart rate, the stress on the heart, things like that, those occur almost immediately, or like I said, certainly within the first 1 to 2 weeks that a woman is pregnant. So those changes have already occurred. And so typically then terminating that pregnancy or ending the life of that child isn't going to change the fact that those physiologic changes have already happened to that woman. And so in fact, I had a patient in the last couple of years that had one of these heart conditions and was told by a couple of people that she should have an abortion because of the risk to her. And when I sat down with her, we had a very frank discussion about, yes, you are at risk, but I think we can at least get you to the point where your child can live outside of you. And she was able to make it to 34 weeks of gestation, delivered a healthy baby boy. At which point then I told her another pregnancy is most definitely not recommended, but she was able to have her son and did actually relatively well. So again, a lot of times with these kind of health conditions, a lot of them, if they're not congenital heart conditions, if it's say poorly controlled diabetes or really high blood pressure or other health conditions that she might have, those can be managed typically during pregnancy. They may see a slight worsening of those conditions, but they can be managed. And again, at least managed until the point that baby can survive outside of mom.
Can you talk to us a little bit about preeclampsia? I feel like that is one that comes up a lot as well. I was reading some articles researching this and that was something that I saw a lot.
Yeah. So preeclampsia is a condition that is only found in pregnancy that involves high blood pressure as as well as protein in the urine. It can affect a woman's kidneys, her liver. It can cause seizures. So it definitely is a significant issue. We see it not infrequently in the U.S. However, one of the articles I know that you sent me to review stated that it happens to 10 to 15% of women, which is blatantly false. It occurs in about 3.5% of pregnancies in the U.S., about 4.5% of pregnancies worldwide. It does account for 10 to 15% of moms who die from pregnancy-related complications, but it does not occur in 10 to 15% of women. The thing about preeclampsia in the U.S. is because women typically get regular prenatal care, preeclampsia is something that almost always you can kind of see it developing. So their blood pressure starts to creep up a little bit, or they start having a little bit of protein in their urine, and it can be managed relatively easily, not minimizing the potential dangers of preeclampsia, but we can manage it. Where you see women dying of preeclampsia typically is in developing countries. I saw women die of it in Kenya because they didn't present for regular prenatal care, and they didn't present until they'd had six seizures already and their kidneys and their livers had shut down.
Right.
You just don't typically see that in the U.S. Now, if you saw a woman that presented with that severity at 20 weeks, which again is very rare, this almost exclusively happens at 25 weeks or beyond in a pregnancy, at which point in the U.S. a baby can be born and has a good chance of survival outside of mom.
Right.
But if you saw a woman in fulminant preeclampsia with organ failure from that at 20 weeks, then again, yes, you would need to deliver her. But that wouldn't be an abortion either. And that kind of preeclampsia that happens pre-viability or prior to 23 to 24 weeks gestation is exceedingly, exceedingly rare.
And that's a point that you touched on right there, where people who are wary of the pro-life movement or are looking for a way to sort of shut down pro-lifers, they say, well, if you outlaw abortion, you're going to be causing the death of millions of women.
Right.
And that's just not accurate.
No,
especially
it's not.
Like what you just said with the preeclampsia and with our points in that delivering someone who is in a life-threatening position is not an abortion. Our intent is not to kill the child. And so that would not be outlawed. It's
right.
not even anywhere near what we're doing.
Right, exactly. Well, and when you look at that, so let's just look at some numbers. Worldwide maternal mortality, there are about 300,000 women that die each year, roughly, from pregnancy-related causes. Now, again, this is a rough estimate because in a lot of developing countries, their reporting just isn't that great. But
right.
in the U.S., the last year that we have stats for was 2013. There were 800 women that died from pregnancy-related complications. So again, that's a higher number than it should be, especially in a country that has as good a medical care as we do. But it's not the hundreds of thousands that people like to reference when they're referring to abortion. The other thing to remember is that 1 in 8 maternal deaths are due to abortion-related complications. So abortion itself contributes to maternal mortality. And so, you know, I think that that is another important thing that we should remember. One of the things that I've heard so many people say, and even unfortunately, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists published a paper that said that pregnancy is actually more dangerous to women than abortion is, that your risk of dying is higher from carrying to term. But a woman's lifetime risk of dying from childbirth in the U.S. is about 0.02%. So very, very low risk of dying from childbirth related complications. Let's compare that to other potential causes of death in the U.S. So your lifetime risk of dying from breast cancer is about 3% compared to the 0.02% of childbirth. Of cardiovascular disease is about 20%. Of cancer altogether is about 19%. The only thing that I found that we can kind of equate to your risk of dying from childbirth is dying in an airplane accident, which is about 0.02%, that would be your cause of death. So, you know, and obviously we don't go around telling people that they shouldn't fly because their risk of death is so high. So I think it's important to look at that. Also, if we look at your risk of dying if you have children versus your risk of dying if you don't have children, women that don't have children actually have lower life expectancies than women who do have children. Women who have children have a lower breast cancer rate than women who don't have children. So there's actually lots of health benefits that are conferred on women for having children. But of course, this isn't talked about.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, you're right. That isn't talked about. And that new documentary that's come out, Hush, kind of digs into that and how this information isn't being shared. And it
right.
should be. If it's,
right.
if it's truthful information, it should be shared.
Right.
Not
right.
swept under the rug for some reason.
Right.
And it's also interesting with a Christian worldview to be able to plug that back into Genesis, into the creation, mm-hmm. and to think, okay, women and their link to childbearing. It's interesting that certain blessings come
right.
from bearing right. children.
Right, exactly.
It's very interesting. Something that if you're not Christian, you kind of miss out on.
I agree.
It's that little connection.
I agree
there.
Wholeheartedly. And you referenced the Hush documentary. I would encourage anyone who's listening who hasn't heard about Hush. It is a wonderful documentary actually made by a pro-choice woman who still says even at the end of the documentary that she's pro-choice. But I actually think that gives this documentary a little bit more credence, especially mm-hmm. when you're talking to people who are pro-choice. So it is available. You can go to their website. I don't have the website in front of me, but just look up Hush documentary and you can actually host a viewing of it in your city or with any size group that you want to. I've actually met the producer who is Christian, and it was great talking with him just about trying to get this information out there about not necessarily why abortion is wrong, because abortion is wrong because it ends the life of an innocent human being, but what's wrong with abortion, that it's actually not beneficial for women at all.
Right. And for those in the Fort Wayne area, we are looking to host a screening ourselves.
Wonderful.
Of it from the Life Defender Student Committee. Yeah, they're going to look at putting on a screening. So be watching for that. Yeah, I watched the documentary and it was really, it was amazing. So definitely. I wanted to touch on a subject that's been in the news a lot, and an article sort of crossed my desk, and that is Zika. Mm-hmm. So we're all absolutely terrified at this point of the Zika virus. We've got radio commercials going on. And this article, in essence, said that the Zika virus isn't really doing everything that it's cracked up to be doing. And
right.
so this microcephaly that is reportedly being caused by the Zika virus in these pregnancies, that the studies that they're doing in Colombia, where they have thousands of women who are Zika positive and not having any trouble with
right.
their pregnancies,
right.
that now we have a conflict of data. Can you speak to that for us a little bit? Clear this up for us.
Sure. Well, I think it's unfortunately a topic that can't be completely cleared up right now, but this article is great, and the study that it referenced is great because it shows that we can't always jump to conclusions that just because you see two things occurring in the same place at the same time doesn't necessarily mean that one is the cause of the other. So where this really started actually was Brazil, that there was this increase in cases of people being infected with the Zika virus, which was transmitted through mosquitoes. And then they saw a subsequent increase in cases of microcephaly, which is essentially where the baby's brain and head don't grow at a normal rate. And a lot of times these infants are severely affected with mental retardation and developmental delays. And so everybody just automatically assumed that it was the Zika virus that was causing this. However, I think it's interesting to see there's about 45 different countries right now, according to the WHO numbers, that have reported Zika outbreaks or confirmed cases of Zika virus infection. But only about 14 countries are reporting cases of microcephaly that they think might be linked to the Zika virus. And again, that's not even conclusive. So what about those other 31 countries that have Zika outbreaks but aren't having cases of microcephaly? And one of the things that I had actually heard previously and now is being confirmed, it seems, by this study, is that it might actually be the pesticides that are being used in certain countries to spray to prevent the mosquito outbreaks that's causing the microcephaly, not the Zika virus itself. And that would explain why in countries like Brazil, we're seeing a huge increase in the number of cases of microcephaly, but in places like Colombia, where they don't use that same pesticide. And this article references that mm-hmm. the pesticide was even placed in the water just before we saw this increase in cases of microcephaly. So certainly an exposure or a potential exposure to Zika virus does not mean that your child is going to have microcephaly. It does not mean that you need to end your pregnancy if you've been exposed to the Zika virus, or even if you test positive for the Zika virus. I'm sure that many people have heard, as we know, that Planned Parenthood is now targeting women in Miami, where they're going around door to door and saying, if you've been exposed to Zika, come to Planned Parenthood. We can give you an abortion because your baby might be born with microcephaly. Absolutely not. Now, am I saying that there's no link between Zika and microcephaly? No, because I don't think we know that for sure yet. Mm-hmm. But it certainly is not a one-to-one correlation of you get the Zika virus, your baby is going to have microcephaly. And it's not even the vast number of cases of Zika exposures or infections that then have babies with microcephaly. So it's very interesting information that just came out. It's still under research, and obviously more research needs to be done. Mm-hmm. I still, as an OBGYN, would caution women if they're planning on becoming pregnant or are currently pregnant, certainly you need to take precautions to avoid Zika exposure just in case there is a potential link, but it certainly looks more and more now like that link isn't going to be there, or certainly isn't going to be as strong as we thought previously.
I mean, and it's also very sad then for these women who were thinking that their pregnancies might have issues and then did terminate earlier this year, those pregnancies that we heard about. Definitely, if you know people who are traveling, share the information.
Right.
Yeah. In these dialogues that we have back and forth with the pro-choice advocates, you know, they like to bring up sort of this medical world because they feel like it's difficult. And it is difficult. It's complicated. Right. And we're not all doctors. Though maybe we should be.
Well, that's why I think that it's nice to learn a way that you don't have to necessarily have medical knowledge to be able to address these concerns. So, you know, in my work with Life Training Institute, we teach pro-life apologetics and we teach people to come back to the central issue of why abortion is wrong. And that is that it intentionally ends the life of an innocent human being. And we know that intentionally ending the life of an innocent human being is wrong. And so really, that's what we need to keep bringing people back to. Again, if it is a situation where mom's life is legitimately in jeopardy, then sometimes we have to act and intervene in order to save her life. But in doing that, one, our intention is not to end the life of that child. Our intention is to save the life of the mother. And two, when possible, we do that in a way that maintains the dignity of that tiny little human life that's growing inside of her. So if that means that we can get her pregnancy to a point where that baby can survive outside of her, wonderful. Then absolutely, that's what's incumbent upon us to do. If that's not possible, then we affect delivery in a humane way that can preserve that child as well as possible for that mom to have the closure and go through the grieving process that she needs to go through and to honor the life of her child and let her know that that child, even though his or her life was very short, that life still had meaning and purpose. And I think if you compare and contrast that to the way that most women perceive maybe that growing life was treated at an abortion facility, it would be very different.
Yeah, definitely. And too, with those early pregnancies that are having to be terminated because of health issues, the pictures that people have been able to take of these little babies, and you can find them, you know, on the internet. I use some of them in our presentations. They are so sweet.
Right.
These little fingers and the little toes. And these mothers are just so distraught over losing their child, but realize that these pictures are going to help the world see that the humanity of the unborn, the humanity of their children.
Right. And be able to help that family go through their grieving process and get some closure like they need to, as opposed to never having that.
Right. Yeah. Never being able to see them. Well, thank you so much, Christina, for joining us, for enlightening us, and helping us further the pro-life movement.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to iChooseLife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.